extraordinary way. His steadiness and kindness had sustained and saved me, but he was gone. Life, because of him and despite his death, went on. And now, 4 years after his death, I found a very different kind of love and a renewed belief in life. These came by way of an elegant, moody, and totally charming Englishman whom I had met early in the year. We both knew that our affair would have to end once the year did, but it was, despite or because of this, a relationship that succeeded, finally, in restoring love and laughter and desire to a walled-in life and a thoroughly iced heart. We had first met at a London dinner party during one of my earlier visits to England. It was, wonderfully and without question, love at first sight. Neither of us had any awareness of anyone else at the dinner table that night, and neither of us, we agreed much later, had ever been so completely and irrationally swept away by the power of our feelings. Several months later, when I returned to London for my year's sabbatical leave, he called and asked me out to dinner. I was spellbound by the ease with which he understood me, and physically overwhelmed by his intensity. I had not been with a man in a very long time, and, understanding this, he was kind and gentle and utterly loving. We saw each other as often as we could. We created our own world of discussion, desire, and love, living on champagne, roses, snow, rain, and borrowed time, an intense and private island of restored life for both of us. I had no hesitancy in telling him everything about myself, and he, like David, was extremely understanding about my manic depressive illness. I told him about my problems with the idea of taking lithium, but also that my life was dependent upon it. I told him that I had discussed with my psychiatrist the possibility of taking a lower dose in hopes of alleviating some of the more problematic side effects. I was eager to do this, but very frightened that I would have a recurrence of my mania. He argued that there would never be a safer or more protected period of time in my life in which to do it, and that he would see me through. After discussing it with my psychiatrist in Los Angeles and my doctor in London, I did, in fact, very slowly cut back on the amount of lithium I was taking. The effect was dramatic. It was as though I had taken bandages off my eyes after many years of partial blindness. A few days after lowering my dose, I realized that my steps were literally bouncier than they had been, and that I was taking in sights and sounds that previously had been filtered through thick layers of gauze. Most significant, I could once again read without effort. I felt more energetic and alive. It was, in short, remarkable. I dreaded leaving England. My moods had held at a more even keel for longer than I could remember. My heart was newly alive, and my mind was in a glorious state, having loped, grazed, and mulled its less medicated self through Oxford and St. George's. I was unwilling to risk losing any more time than I already had. Life had become worth not losing. Inevitably, the year passed. The snows and warming brandies of the English winter gave way to the soft rains and white wines of early summer. Roses and horses appeared in Hyde Park, and gorgeous diaphanous apple blossoms spread out over the black branches of the trees in St. James's Park. I was reluctant to leave England, and even more reluctant to return to a city I had come to associate not only with a grueling academic career, but also with breakdowns, the cold bloodlessness following in their wake, and the draining charade of pretending to be well when I wasn't, and going through the motions of being pleasant when I felt dreadful. I was, however, very wrong in my forebodings. The year had served as far more than just a restful interlude. It had been, in fact, truly restorative. Teaching was, once again, fun. Supervising the clinical work of the residents and interns was a pleasure. And seeing patients gave me the opportunity to try and put into practice some of what I had learned from my own experiences. Mental exhaustion had taken a long, terrible toll, but, strangely, it was only in feeling well, energetic, and high-spirited again that I had any true sense of the toll taken. So, work went well and relatively smoothly. Most of my time was spent working on a textbook that I was co-authoring about manic depressive illness, delighted with how much easier it was to read, analyze, and retain the medical literature, which, until only recently, had been a terrible struggle to comprehend. Much as I had done when frightened or upset as a child, I had found that asking questions, tracking down answers as best I could, and then asking yet more questions was the best way to provide a distance from anxiety and a framework for understanding. Lowering my lithium level had allowed not only a clarity of thinking, but also a vividness and intensity of experience back into my life. Their absence had left gaping hollows in the ways in which I could respond to the world. The too rigid structuring of my moods and temperament, which had resulted from a higher dose of lithium, made me less resilient to stress than a lower dose. Therefore, and rather oddly, there was a new solidness to both my thinking and emotions. Gradually, as I began to look around me, I realized that this was the kind of evenness and predictability most people had, and probably took for granted throughout their lives. As I gradually entered into the world of more stable moods and more predictable life, I began to realize that I knew very little about it and had no real idea of what it was like to live in such a place. In many ways, I was a stranger to the normal world. But I had now finally convinced myself that a certain intellectual steadiness was not only desirable, but essential. Somewhere in my heart, however, I continued to believe that intense and lasting love was possible only in a climate of somewhat tumultuous passions. This, I felt, consigned me to being with a man whose temperament was largely similar to my own. I was late to understand that chaos and intensity are no substitute for lasting love, nor are they necessarily an improvement on real life. Normal people are not always boring. On the contrary, it has been with pleasure and not inconsiderable pain that I have learned about the possibilities of love, its steadiness and its growth, from my husband, the man with whom I have lived for almost a decade. I first met Richard Wyatt at a Christmas party in Washington, and he certainly was not at all what I expected. I had known of him. He is a well-known schizophrenia researcher, chief of neuropsychiatry at the National Institute of Mental Health, and the author of more than 700 scientific papers and books. But I was completely unprepared for the handsome, unassuming, quietly charming man I found myself talking with. He was not only attractive, he was also very easy to talk to, and we got together often in the months that followed. Within 2 years of having met, I made plans to move to Washington. The whole thing had been a relatively short but very convincing courtship. I loved being with him and found him not just unbelievably smart, but imaginative, fiendishly curious, refreshingly open-minded, and wonderfully easygoing. Even then, very early on in our relationship, I could not imagine my life without him. I resigned my tenured position at the medical school with genuine regret at leaving the University of California, which I loved, and considerable anxiety about the financial implications of giving up a secure income. Overall, however, I left Los Angeles with few regrets. It had never been the city of angels to me. Rather, it had been filled with near death, a completely shattered innocence, and a recurrently lost and broken mind. Life in California had been often good, but the ever-promising, always elusive, and infinitely complex promised land seemed to me to be exactly that. Promised. Richard and I moved into a house in Georgetown and quickly confirmed what our common sense should have told us. We could not have been more different. He was low-key. I was intense. He was slow to anger. I quick. The world registered gently upon him, whereas I was fast to feel both pleasure and pain. We were a complete mismatch. Yet, not once in the years we have been together have I doubted Richard's love for me, nor mine for him. Love, like life, is much stranger and far more complicated than one is brought up to believe. Our common intellectual interests, medicine, science, and psychiatry, are strong ones, and our differences in both substance and style have allowed each of us a great deal of independence, which has been essential, and which ultimately has bound us close to one another over the years. My life with Richard has become a safe harbor, an extremely interesting place filled with love and warmth and always a bit open to the outer sea. But, like all safe harbors that managed to retain fascination as well as safety, it was less than smooth sailing to reach. No amount of love can cure madness or unblacken one's dark moods. Love can help. It can make the pain more tolerable. But, always, One is beholden to medication that may or may not always work and may or may not be bearable. Madness, on the other hand, most certainly can and often does kill love through its mistrustfulness, unrelenting pessimism, discontents, erratic behavior, and, especially, through its savage moods. Experience and love have, over much time, taught both of us a great deal about dealing with manic depressive illness. I occasionally laugh and tell him that his imperturbability is worth 300 milligrams of lithium a day to me. And it's probably true. But if love is not the cure, it certainly can act as a very strong medicine. As John Donne has written, it is not so pure and abstract as one might have thought and wished, but it does endure, and it does grow. Seated in a chair, with quick access to escape through the back door of the conference room, Jim Watson was twitching, peering, scanning, squinting, and yawning. Jim is not good at looking interested when he is bored, and it was impossible to know if he really was thinking about the science at hand, the genetics and molecular biology of manic depressive illness, or was instead mulling about whatever heated and passionate enthusiasm occupied his mind and heart at the moment. An intense and exceedingly blunt man, he is not someone who tends to bring out the dispassionate side of people. For myself, I find him fascinating and very wonderful. Jim is genuinely independent and, in an increasingly bland world, a true zebra amongst horses. While it could be argued that it is relatively easy to be independent and unpredictable if you have won the Nobel Prize for your contributions to discovering the structure of life, it is also clear that the same underlying temperament, intense, competitive, imaginative, and iconoclastic, helped propel his initial pursuit for the structure of DNA. But however interesting he is as a person, Jim is, first and foremost, a scientific leader. Director, until only very recently, of one of the foremost molecular biology laboratories in the world, Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, and the first director of the National Center for Human Genome Research. In the past few years, he has turned his interest toward the search for genes responsible for manic depressive illness. Because the scientific understanding of manic depressive illness is so ultimately beholden to the field of molecular biology, it is a world in which I have spent an increasing amount of time. It is a field clearly in pursuit of the most fundamental of understandings, a search for the biological equivalent of quarks and leptons. The meeting where Watson was peering and twitching and yawning was focused specifically on the genetic basis of manic depressive illness, with the intent of bringing together clinical psychiatrists, geneticists, and molecular biologists to share information about their research methods, findings, and the pedigrees of the affected families whose genetic material is being analyzed. Pedigree after pedigree was being projected onto the screen, some with relatively few ill family members, others containing large numbers of squares and circles that had been completely blackened in, indicating men or women who suffered from manic depressive illness. Half-blackened circles and squares depicted depressive illness, and an S, cross, or slash mark flagged those individuals who had committed suicide. It seemed very likely, in looking around the room, that among these scientists, and somewhere within these pedigrees, the location of the gene or genes responsible for manic depressive illness was going to be found. It was a very exciting thought, because once the genes are located, early and far more accurate diagnosis is likely to follow. So, too, is more specific, safe, less problematic, and effective treatment. The slides went off, the curtains were pulled back, and I remembered a trip I had taken years ago down the Mississippi with Mogens Skou, who is a Danish psychiatrist, more than anyone, responsible for the introduction of lithium as a treatment for manic depressive illness. He and I had decided to skip a day's sessions of the American Psychiatric Association's annual meeting and take a boat ride. Mogens turned to me and asked me point blank, why was I really studying mood disorders? I must have looked as uncomfortable as I felt because, changing tack, he said, well, why don't I tell you why I study mood disorders? He proceeded to tell me about all of the depression and manic depressive illness in his own family, how devastating it had been, and how, because of this, years ago, he had been desperately searching the medical literature for any new experimental treatments. He talked with ease about his family history of mental illness and emphasized that it had been this strongly personal motivation that had driven virtually all of his research. He made it clear to me that he suspected my involvement in clinical research about manic depressive illness was likewise personally motivated. Feeling a bit trapped, but also relieved, I decided to be honest about my own and my family's history, and soon the two of us were drawing our pedigrees on the backs of table napkins. I was amazed at how many of my squares and circles were darkened, or darkened with a question mark placed underneath. Manic depressive illness occurred repeatedly throughout the three generations I had knowledge of on my father's side of the family. Asterisks representing suicide attempts showed up like a starfield. We talked for a long time about my illness, lithium, its side effects, and my suicide attempt. Talking with Mons was extremely helpful, in part because he aggressively encouraged me to use my own experiences in my research, writing, and teaching, and in part because it was important to me to be able to talk with a senior professor who had used his experiences to make a profound difference in the lives of hundreds of thousands of people, including my own. No matter what struggles I had had with lithium, it was painfully clear to me that without it, I would have been long dead or on the back wards of a state hospital. I was one of many who owed their lives to the black circles and squares in Sko's family tree. The fact that manic depressive illness is a genetic disease brings with it, not surprisingly, very complicated and often difficult emotions. At one extreme is the terrible shame and guilt that one can be made to feel. Several years ago, when I was living in Los Angeles, I went to a physician recommended to me by a colleague. After examining me and finding out that I had been on lithium for many years, he asked me an extended series of questions about my psychiatric history. He also asked me whether or not I planned to have children. Having generally been treated with intelligence and compassion by my various doctors, I had no reason to be anything but direct about my extensive history of mania and depression, although I also made it clear that I was a good lithium responder. I told him that I very much wanted to have children, which immediately led to his asking me if I knew that manic depressive illness was a genetic disease. I said, yes, of course. At that point, in an icy and imperious voice I can hear to this day, he stated, as though it were God's truth, "You shouldn't have children. You have manic depressive illness." I felt sick, unbelievably and utterly sick, and deeply humiliated. I asked if his concerns about my having children stemmed from the fact that, because of my illness, he thought I would be an inadequate mother, or simply that he thought it would be best to avoid bringing another manic depressive into the world. Ignoring or missing my sarcasm, he replied, "Both." I asked him to leave the room, put on my clothes, knocked on his office door, told him to go to hell, and left. I walked across the street to my car, sat down shaking, and sobbed until I was exhausted. Brutality takes many forms, and what he had done was not only brutal, but unprofessional and uninformed as well. It did the kind of lasting damage that only something which cuts so quick and deep to the heart can do. Oddly enough, it had never occurred to me not to have children simply because I had manic depressive illness. Even in my blackest depressions, I had never regretted being born. Overwhelmingly, I was grateful for life, and I couldn't imagine not wanting to pass on life to someone else. All things considered, I had had a marvelous, albeit turbulent and occasionally awful, existence. Of course I had had serious concerns. How could one not? Would I, for example, be able to take care of my children properly? What would happen to them if I got severely depressed? What would happen to them if I got manic, if my judgment became impaired, if I became violent or uncontrollable? How would it be to have to watch my own children struggle with depression or insanity if they themselves became ill? All of these things I had thought about 1,000 times, but never, not once, had I questioned having children. And, despite the cold-bloodedness of the doctor who examined me and told me I shouldn't, I would have delighted in having had a houseful of children, as David and I once had planned. But it just didn't work out that way. David died, and Richard, the only man since David's death I wanted to have children with, already had 3 from a previous marriage. Not having children of my own is the single most intolerable regret of my life. I do, however, have 2 nephews and a niece, each wonderful and quite remarkable in his or her own way, and I enjoy, truly beyond description, my relationships with them. Now and again, despite my strong commitment to the scientific efforts that are being made to track down the genes for manic depressive illness, I have very real concerns about what finding the genes might actually mean. Clearly, if better and earlier diagnosis and more specific, less troublesome treatments result, then the benefits to individuals who have manic depressive illness, to their families, and to society will be extraordinary. It is, in fact, only a matter of time until these benefits will be available. But what are the dangers to prenatal diagnostic testing? Will prospective parents choose to abort fetuses that carry the genes for manic depressive illness, even though it is a treatable disease? Do we risk making the world a blander, more homogenized place if we get rid of the genes for manic depressive illness? What are the risks to the risk-takers, those restless individuals who join with others in society to propel the arts, business, politics, and science? Are manic depressives, like spotted owls and clouded leopards, in danger of becoming an endangered species? These are very difficult ethical issues, particularly because manic depressive illness can confer advantages on both the society and individuals. The disease appears to convey its advantages not only through its relationship to the artistic temperament and imagination, but through its influence on many eminent scientists as well as business, religious, military, and political leaders. Subtler effects are also involved because it is a common illness, with a wide range of temperamental, behavioral, and cognitive expression. These scientific and ethical issues are real ones. Fortunately, they are being actively considered by the federal government's Genome Project and other groups of scientists and ethicists. But they remain immensely troubling problems, and will remain so for many years to come. Science remains quite remarkable in its ability to raise new problems even as it solves old ones. It moves quickly, often beautifully, and as it moves, it brings high expectations in its wake. Sitting on one of the hard, uncomfortable chairs that are so characteristic of medical conferences, I was semi-oblivious to the world. My mind was on hold after having been lulled into a mild hypnotic state by the click, click, click of the changing of slides in a carousel. A group of my colleagues and I were in the Colorado Rockies, and everyone else with any sense at all was skiing. Suddenly, my ears perked up. A flat, numbingly objective voice was mumbling something about, quote, structural brain abnormalities in bipolar illness, unquote. My structurally abnormal brain came to attention, and a chill shot down my spine. The mumbling continued. In the bipolar patients we have studied, there is a significantly increased number of small areas of focal signal hyperintensity suggestive of abnormal tissue. These are what neurologists sometimes refer to as unidentified bright objects, or UBOs. The audience laughed appreciatively. I laughed with somewhat less than total enthusiasm. The speaker went on. The medical significance of these UBOs is unclear, but we know that they are associated with other conditions, such as Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, and multi-infarct dementias. I was right. I should have gone skiing. Against my better judgment, I pointed my head in the direction of the screen. The slides were riveting, and as always, I was captivated by the unbelievable detail of the structure of the brain that was being revealed by the newest versions of the magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, techniques. There is a beauty as well as an intuitive appeal to the brain scanning methods, especially the high-resolution MRI pictures and the gorgeous multicolored scans from the PET scan studies. Using PET, for example, a depressed brain will show up in cold, brain-inactive, deep blues, dark purples, and hunter greens. The same brain, when hypomanic, however, is lit up like a Christmas tree with vivid patches of bright reds and yellows and oranges. Never has the color and structure of science so completely captured the cold, inward deadness of depression or the vibrant, active engagement of mania. I was, in spite of myself, caught up by the science. When I got back to Johns Hopkins, I buttonholed neurology colleagues and grilled my associates who were doing the MRI studies. I scurried off to the library to read up on what was known. It is, after all, one thing to believe intellectually that the disease is in your brain. It is quite another thing to actually see it. I sat down to read, and found that, as usual in new fields of clinical medicine, there were far more questions than answers, and it was unclear what any of these findings really meant. There could be any number of explanations. The odds were very strong, however, that these UBOs meant something. In a strange way, though, after reading through a long series of studies, I ended up more reassured and less frightened. The very fact that the science was moving so quickly had a way of generating hope. And if the changes in brain structure did turn out to be meaningful, I was certainly glad that first-class researchers were studying them. Without science, there would be no such hope. No hope at all. And, whatever else, it certainly gave new meaning to the concept of losing one's mind. There are many reasons why I've been reluctant to be open about having manic depressive illness. Some of the reasons are personal, many are professional. The personal issues revolve, to a large extent, around issues of family privacy, especially because the illness under consideration is a genetic one, as well as a general belief that personal matters should be kept personal. I also have been very concerned, perhaps unduly so, with how knowing that I have manic depressive illness will affect people's perception of who I am and what I do. Finally, I am deeply wary that by speaking publicly or writing about such intensely private aspects of my life, I will return to them one day and find them bleached of meaning and feeling. By putting myself in the position of speaking too freely and too often, I am concerned that the experiences will become remote, inaccessible, and far distant behind me. I fear that the experiences will become those of someone else rather than my own. My major concerns about discussing my illness, however, have tended to be professional in nature. Early in my career, these concerns were centered on fears that the California Board of Medical Examiners would not grant me a license if it knew about my manic depression. As time went by, I became less afraid of such administrative actions, but I became increasingly concerned that my professional anonymity in teaching and research, such as it was, would be compromised. I cringe at the thought that residents and interns may, in deference to what they perceive to be my feelings, not say what they really think, or not ask the questions that they otherwise should and would ask. Many of these concerns carry over into my research and writing as well. I have written extensively in medical and scientific journals about manic depressive illness. Will my work now be seen by my colleagues as somehow biased because of my illness? It is a discomforting thought, although one of the advantages of science is that one's work ultimately is either replicated or it is not. I worry also about my colleagues' reactions once I am open about my illness. If, for example, I am attending a scientific meeting and ask a question or challenge a speaker, will my question now be seen as highly subjective, an idiosyncratic view of someone who has a personal axe to grind? It is an awful prospect, giving up one's cloak of academic objectivity. But, of course, my work has been tremendously colored by my emotions and my experiences. They have deeply affected my teaching, my advocacy work, my clinical practice, and what I have chosen to study. Most important, however, as a clinician, I have had to consider the question, do I really think that someone with mental illness should be allowed to treat patients? When I left the University of California in the winter of 1986 to return to Washington, I was very eager to continue teaching and to obtain an academic appointment at a university medical school. Richard, who had gone to medical school at Johns Hopkins, thought I would love it. At his suggestion, I applied to the Department of Psychiatry for a faculty appointment, and I started teaching at Hopkins within a few months of moving back east. Richard was right. I loved Hopkins straight away. And, as he predicted, one of the many pleasures I found in being on the Hopkins faculty was the seriousness with which teaching obligations are taken. The excellence of clinical care was another. It was only a matter of time. The issue of clinical privileges was bound to come up. With the usual sense of profound uneasiness that for me accompanies having to look through official hospital appointment forms, I stared at the packet of papers in front of me. The Johns Hopkins Hospital, in imposing capital letters, was written across the top of the page. Scanning downwards, I saw that it was, as I had expected, an application for clinical privileges. Hoping for the best, but expecting the worst, I decided to tackle all of the straightforward questions first. I quickly checked no to a long series of questions about professional liability, malpractice insurance, and professional sanctions. These questions were easy to answer, having managed thus far, in a ridiculously litigious age, to avoid being sued for malpractice. It was the next section, personal information, that made my heart race. And sure enough, before too long, I found the question that was going to require something more than just a check mark in the no column. Are you currently suffering from or receiving treatment for any disability or illness, including drug or alcohol abuse, that would impair the proper performance of your duties and responsibilities at this hospital? After thinking about it for a while, I finally wrote next to it, per discussion with the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry. Then, with a sinking feeling, I telephoned my chairman at Hopkins and asked him if we could get together for lunch. A week or so later, we met at the hospital restaurant. He was as talkative and funny as ever, so we spent several pleasant minutes catching up. Then, with my hands clenched in my lap and my heart in my throat, I told him about the clinical privileges form, my manic depressive illness, and the treatment I was receiving for it. My closest colleague at Hopkins already knew about my illness, as I had always told those physicians with whom I most closely practiced. I have been both fortunate and careful. The possibility always exists that my illness, or the illness of any clinician for that matter, might interfere with clinical judgment. Questions about hospital privileges are neither unfair nor irrelevant. I don't like having to answer them, but they are completely reasonable questions. The privilege to practice is exactly that, a privilege. It is not a right. The real dangers, of course, come about from those clinicians who are hesitant to seek out psychiatric treatment. Left untreated or unsupervised, many become ill, endangering not only their own lives, but the lives of others. It is not uncommon for depressed physicians to prescribe antidepressant medications for themselves. The results can be disastrous. Hospitals and professional organizations need to acknowledge the extent to which untreated doctors, nurses, and psychologists present risks to the patients they treat. But they also need to encourage effective and compassionate treatment and work out guidelines for safeguards and intelligent, non-paternalistic supervision. Untreated mood disorders result in risks not only to patients, but to the doctors themselves. Far too many doctors commit suicide each year. One recent study concluded that, until quite recently, the United States lost annually the equivalent of a medium-sized medical school intake from suicide alone. Most physician suicides are due to depression or manic depressive illness, both of which are eminently treatable. Physicians, unfortunately, not only suffer from a higher rate of mood disorders than the general population, they also have a greater access to extremely effective means of suicide. Doctors, of course, need first to heal themselves, but they also need accessible, competent treatment that allows them to heal. The medical and administrative system that harbors them must be one that encourages treatment, provides reasonable guidelines for supervised practice, but also be one that does not tolerate incompetence or jeopardize patient care. Doctors, as my chairman is fond of pointing out, are there to treat patients. Patients should never have to pay, either literally or medically, for the problems and sufferings of their doctors. I strongly agree with him about this, so it was not without a sense of dread that I waited for his response to my telling him that I was being treated for manic depressive illness, and that I needed to discuss the issue of my hospital privileges with him. I watched his face for some inclination of how he felt. Suddenly, he reached across the table, put his hand on mine, and smiled. "Kay, dear," he said, "I know you have manic depressive illness." He paused and then laughed. If we got rid of all of the manic depressives on the medical school faculty, not only would we have a much smaller faculty, but it would also be a far more boring one. We are all, as Byron put it, differently organized. We each move within the restraints of our temperament and live up only partially to its possibilities. 30 years of living with manic depressive illness has made me increasingly aware of both the restraints and possibilities that come with it. The ominous, dark, and deathful quality that I felt as that young child watching the high, clear skies filled with smoke and flames is always there, somehow laced into the beauty and vitality of life. That darkness is an integral part of who I am, and it takes no effort of imagination on my part to remember the months of relentless blackness and exhaustion, or the terrible efforts it took in order to teach, read, write, see patients, and keep relationships alive. More deeply layered over, but all too readily summoned up with the first trace of depression, are the unforgettable images of violence, utter madness, mortifying behavior, and moods savage to experience, and even more disturbingly brutal in their effects upon others. Yet, however genuinely dreadful these moods and memories have been, they have always been offset by the elation and vitality of others. And, whenever a mild and gentlish wave of brilliant and bubbling manic enthusiasm comes over me, I am transported by its exuberance to earlier, more intense and passionate times. The vividness that mania infuses into one's experiences of life creates strong, keenly recollected states, much as war must, and love and early memories surely do. Because of this, there is now for me a rather bittersweet exchange of a comfortable and settled present existence for a troubled but intensely lived past. There are still occasional sirens to this past, and there remains a seductive, if increasingly rare, desire to recreate the furor and fever of earlier times. How could one, should one, recapture that intensity or re-experience the glorious moods of dancing all night and into the morning, the gliding through starfields and dancing along the rings of Saturn, the zany manic enthusiasms? This longing is inevitable, perhaps in any life, but there is an extra twist of almost painful nostalgia brought about by having lived a life of particularly intense moods. This makes it even harder to leave the past behind, and life on occasion becomes a kind of elegy for lost moods. I miss the lost intensities, and I find myself unconsciously reaching out for them. These longings are now, for the most part, only longings, and I no longer feel compelled to recreate the intensities. The consequences are too awful, too final, and too damaging. Still, the seductiveness of these unbridled and intense moods is powerful, and the ancient dialogue between reason and the senses is almost always more interestingly and passionately resolved in favor of the senses. The milder manias have a way of promising and, for a very brief while, delivering springs in the winter in epical vitalities. In the cold light of day, however, the reality and destructiveness of rekindled illness tend to dampen the evocativeness of such selectively remembered, wistful, intense, and gentle moments. Any temptation that I may have to recapture such moods by lowering my lithium level is quickly hosed down by the cold knowledge that a gentle intensity soon becomes first a frenetic one, and then, finally, an uncontrolled insanity. I am too frightened that I will again become morbidly depressed or virulently manic, either of which would, in turn, rip apart every aspect of my life, relationships, and work that I find most meaningful, to seriously consider any change in my medical treatment. I am fundamentally optimistic about remaining well, but I know my illness from enough different vantage points to remain somewhat fatalistic about the future. As a result, I know that I listen to lectures about new treatments for manic depressive illness with far more than just a professional interest. There is always a part of my mind that is preparing for the worst, and another part of my mind that believes if I prepare enough for it, the worst won't happen. Many years of living with the cyclic upheavals of manic depressive illness have made me more philosophical, better armed, and more able to handle the inevitable swings of mood and energy. Therefore, I now move more easily with the fluctuating tides of energy, ideas, and enthusiasms that I remain so subject to. These comings and goings, this grace and godlessness, have become such a part of my life that the wild colors and sounds now have become less strange and less strong, and the blacks and grays that inevitably follow are, likewise, less dark and frightening. Although I continue to have emergences of my old summer manias, they have been gutted not only of most of their terror, but most of their earlier indescribable beauty and glorious rush as well. Sludged by time, tempered by a long string of jading experiences, and brought to their knees by medication, they now coalesce each July into brief, occasionally dangerous cracklings together of black moods and high passions. And then they, too, pass. We all build internal seawalls to keep at bay the sadness of life and the often overwhelming forces within the mind. In whatever way we do this, through love, work, family, faith, friends, denial, alcohol, drugs, or medication, we build these walls stone by stone over a lifetime. One of the problems is to construct these barriers of such a height and strength that one has a true harbor, a sanctuary away from turmoil and pain, but yet low enough and permeable enough to let in fresh seawater that will fend off the inclination toward brackishness. For someone with my cast of mind and mood, medication is an integral element of this wall. Without it, I would be constantly beholden to the crushing movements of a mental sea. I would, unquestionably, be dead or insane. But love is, to me, the ultimately more extraordinary part of the breakwater wall. It helps to shut out the terror and awfulness while allowing in life and beauty and vitality. After each seeming death within my mind or heart, love has returned to recreate hope and to restore life. It has, at its best, made the inherent sadness of life bearable and its beauty manifest. It has, inexplicably and savingly, provided not only cloak but lantern for the darker seasons and grimmer weather. I long ago abandoned the notion of a life without storms, or a world without dry and killing seasons. Life is too complicated, too constantly changing, to be anything but what it is. And I am, by nature, too mercurial to be anything but deeply wary of the grave unnaturalness involved in any attempt to exert too much control over essentially uncontrollable forces. There will always be propelling, disturbing elements, and they will be there until, as Robert Lowell put it, the watch is taken from the wrist. It is, at the end of the day, the individual moments of restlessness, of bleakness, of strong persuasions and maddened enthusiasms that inform one's life, change the nature and direction of one's work, and give final meaning and color to one's loves and friendships. I have often asked myself whether, given the choice, I would choose to have manic depressive illness. If lithium were not available to me or didn't work for me, the answer would be a simple no, and it would be an answer laced with terror. But lithium does work for me, and therefore I suppose I can afford to pose the question. Strangely enough, I think I would choose to have it. It's complicated. Depression is awful beyond words or sounds or images. I would not go through an extended one again. It bleeds relationships through suspicion, lack of confidence and self-respect, the inability to enjoy life, to walk or talk or think normally, the exhaustion, the night terrors, the day terrors. There is nothing good to be said for it. So why would I want anything to do with this illness? Because I honestly believe that as a result of it, I have felt more things more deeply, had more experiences more intensely, loved more and been more loved, laughed more often for having cried more often, appreciated more the springs for all the winters, appreciated death and life more, seen the finest and the most terrible in people, and slowly learned the values of caring, loyalty, and seeing things through. I have seen the breadth and depth and width of my mind and heart, and seen how frail they both are, and how ultimately unknowable they both are. Depressed, I have crawled to get across a room, and have done it for month after month. But, normal or manic, I have run faster, thought faster, loved faster than most I know. And I think much of this is related to my illness, the intensity it gives to things, and the perspective it forces on me. I think it has made me test the limits of my mind, which, while wanting, is holding, and the limits of my upbringing, family, education, and friends. The countless hypomanias and mania itself all have brought into my life a different level of sensing and feeling and thinking. Even when I have been most psychotic, I have been aware of finding new corners in my mind and heart. Some of those corners were incredible and beautiful, and made me feel as though I could die right then, and the images would sustain me. Some of them were grotesque and ugly, and I never wanted to see them again. But always there were those new corners, and when feeling my normal self, beholden for that self to medicine and love, I cannot imagine becoming jaded to life, because I know of those limitless corners with their limitless views.
This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.